Hey, we're starting a new series, and I could not be more excited myself to be here opening up this new series on the minor prophets. God still speaks. It really is amazing. These minor prophets are given so little sort of space in Scripture, and the only reason they're minor is because actually their books are smaller than, say, the bigger prophets. But let me tell you, it does not mean that there's less content. Actually, I would say the nectar that comes out of these little books is so intense, you sometimes have to kind of take it dosage by dosage, little by little. Because God is speaking to His nation. And as He speaks to His nation, He's trying to be very articulate to them in a short space, in this book. Now, Hosea is who we're looking at today. And Hosea is an amazing book. Let me tell you something. If at any level you're here this morning, whether believer or not, and you feel like you're disconnected, like your relationship with God at some level is disconnected, you're going to love the book of Hosea. The book of Hosea is an intense book. I always chuckle a little bit at people who come to me and they say, you know, I never watch a rated R movie. I never watch a rated R movie. Now, I'm not necessarily condoning you go watch rated R movies, but I usually think to myself, especially if they're a churchgoer, if they've ever read the Bible. Because let me tell you something, the intensity of the language that happens in the book of Hosea is unbelievable. And even though Hosea is the first book chronologically as you read the Bible, Hosea is actually, in terms of a minor prophet, he's not the first historically. He's actually number 6 out of 12. What you need to know about Hosea and about their time that is very important to our conversation is, number one, it was a time of intense prosperity in the nation of Israel. Hosea was speaking mostly to the northern part of Israel, and there was just a prosperity that was going on. In fact, this time in the Bible, the children of God, the children of Israel, they were so prosperous, only second to the time of Solomon. Intense wealth. But the other thing you need to know is that they were worshiping idols pretty significantly. They were leaving their God and they were going and associating themselves. And when we walk through this book and we see the intensity of God's language to His people, we learn something. And what we learn is that God loves people and He loves His people intensely. Intensely. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever been a part of an intervention? Let me explain to you what I mean when I say intervention. An intervention is typically a word that we use in our society in terms of when we look at somebody that we love, somebody that we care for, and we see them going through life and they're really living a damaging lifestyle. It could be anything. It could be something where maybe they're eating too much food. Maybe they're overweight. They're obese. Somehow, they're just putting their health in jeopardy. And they're just, it almost seems like they're not even cognizant of what they're doing. They're just, they need to be intervened. There needs to be an intervention. Maybe, possibly, it has to do with somebody who is spending money, who just constantly spends money and is not thinking about the ramifications of what they're doing. And as an outsider looking into that relationship, you look in the relationship and you say, man, I just want to sit down with them and have a conversation with them. Because I don't think they're watching the damage that they're doing to themselves or the damage that they're doing to the relationships around them. Maybe it's somebody who's hoarding, who's taking things and just constantly collecting things, and their house is almost unlivable. Have you ever been a part of an intervention? Have you ever been a person who maybe actually intervention has happened with you? Maybe somebody came and spoke into your life. Interventions, the best ones of them, are born out of a heart of love. A heart of genuine concern. A heart that is so intensely thoughtful of what is going on in this person's life that they want to try and save them from themselves. Maybe you know of somebody. Maybe you can remember the conversation. It's a very hard conversation. You sort of picture in your mind there's one person that comes down and it's the person who you're going to intervene with. And sometimes you bring family members or friends and you sit down and literally the tension in the room is palpable. And your mind is prepared to say certain things, and you start, then I'll go behind you, and there's just this intense dialogue that's about to start. But you're praying, you're hoping, you're asking, you're just praying that somehow it would penetrate their life and their heart, and that their actions would change. Because you genuinely care for this person. What's interesting about an intervention is actually many people sometimes enter an intervention and they talk about it and they go into the space thinking, if I can just convince them, if I can just logically work them through the process, if I can help them see logically using maybe even data to help really give them a picture of what they're doing, I think that will nail it. So they take, for example, sometimes they think about this. They go, this person is overweight. They're eating too much. In fact, let's just say they're eating too many Oreos. Is there anybody in this room that could identify with this? Right? I mean, right? Oreos. So the conversation, they sit down and they go, they say, listen, and I'm just going to use a name, Peter. Peter, you know, did you realize that Oreos, each Oreo has 80 calories in it? And if you eat 43.75 Oreos, that equals 3,500 calories, which is equivalent to 1 pound. In other words, every 43.75 Oreos that you eat, you're adding a pound of weight upon yourself. Your heart is going to go. Now, I know that you can't eat that all at once because in one package, there's actually only 3 rows, each of them having 12 cookies. So there's only 36 cookies in a package of Oreos. Some of you are shaking your head because you know this too well. But still, even though you're not consuming a whole pound, you're consuming 82% of a pound, 2,880 calories in one package of Oreo. That is literally 13.2 ounces. Don't you see what you're doing to yourself? Right, most of you are going, that is not going to convince anybody. But I can tell you, it took me half an hour to do the research to get that paragraph down. Oh my goodness. No. Yeah, time for an Oreo. Who wants an Oreo? You know, actually the best way to have an intervention is not to use data. And it's not to use sort of your mind, because their mind is not tracking well. If they could think logically about what they're doing, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. The best way to have an intervention is to give people a picture, to somehow create an image in their mind. If you can create an image in their mind, if somehow you can create a picture, there's something about a picture that the simplicity of it just speaks. After all, a picture is worth a... That's right. Why say 1,000 words when you can give them a picture? An intervention, and they can associate with the story in a picture. So like, we're going to try something here real quick if I can. In a minute, I'm going to show you a picture on the screen, right? When I show you this picture on the screen, what I'm actually going to do is this. I'm actually going to say a phrase, right? And as I say this phrase, I think what's going to happen is when you see this random picture, automatically your brain is going to say a second part of a phrase. The reason is because this image and this phrase was used in an intervention. When you see this and you identify with this, help me finish the phrase. So I'm going to say a phrase, and then I'm going to point to you, and I'm going to say, please repeat the second half of the phrase. Let's see if we can do this. We haven't tried this, right? You ready? Here it is. This is your brain. Okay, let's try it again. Ready? Here we go. I think you're there now. Ready? This is your brain. There you go. Clearly, we have a lot of drug users in this audience. Why did you say that? This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs, right? You remember that? I didn't even show you the whole commercial that came out or the picture of the egg and the egg frying in the pan. But isn't it amazing how a simple picture, it just sticks in your mind? That came out in the mid-80s, which for those of you who are my age, that was about 30 years ago. I know. 30 years ago, and still, as I show you a random picture and I start the phrase for you, you can resonate with the second half of the phrase because an image gives you the clarity of thought. Hosea. The pictures that are in Hosea are intense. They are pictures that I will guarantee you'll never forget the book of Hosea after this message. The intensity of the language, the intensity of the pictures that God is trying, He's trying to intervene with the people that He loves and He cares for. He's going all in because He wants to reach His people. And so we find ourselves with Hosea. But not only does the pictures that are used in Hosea resonate and help us remember, but actually Hosea's life itself was a picture. Let's turn to Hosea chapter 1. Hosea chapter 1, and I'm going to read you just his backstory so that you can identify the story within the language. This is God speaking to Hosea and laying out the ministry for this guy named Hosea, which lasted about 34 years in the northern kingdom. You ready? Here's what he says in verse 2. And when the Lord first spoke to Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go and take yourself a wife of whoredom. Are we okay? Some of you who have never been to church, you may never thought you might hear the word whore in church. So I just want to make sure we're okay. This is the Bible. I'm reading specifically from it. He's literally telling Hosea, you're going to be a prophet, but I don't want you to just say it. I want you to live it out. Live it out in your life so that they can see your life and go, that's a picture. He says, go take a whore for a wife. And have children of whoredom, because the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So he went and he took Gomer, the daughter of Bilbam, and she conceived and bore a son. But it doesn't end there. Keep going. And the Lord said to him, after call his name son, his son, call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. Jezreel is a very famous name in Scripture. In fact, for those of you who know back in the times of Elijah, this is that space right there. His name means God sows. God sows. In other words, what God sows, He will also reap. There is going to be punishment. What's the punishment? Well, this is such a famous passage because actually Jezebel died in that space. In fact, the whole family of Ahab was killed in a space called Jezreel. His son is a picture, but it doesn't stop there. I will put an end to the kingdom of the house, verse 5. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Listen to verse 6. She conceived again and bore a daughter. And the Lord said, call her name No Mercy. Literally, her daughter's name is No Mercy, right? Can you imagine Hosea sitting at a soccer field watching his kid playing soccer? The girl's out there and she's amazing at soccer. She's going around, woo, woo, she's going, here it goes, there she goes, No Mercy, there she goes, and No Mercy scores. Somebody turns next to Hosea and says, man, you named your daughter just right. She has no mercy on the opponent. Hosea says, oh, actually, the reason she's named No Mercy is because God named her, and this is my wife, who you probably recognize. And it's because you're living waywardly. Away from God. Just think about how this guy lives in the world. It doesn't even finish there. Verse 7, but I will have no mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by their bow or by the sword or by the war of horsemen. In verse 8, then she, when she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, call his name not my people. For you are not my people, and I am not your God. It's hard to go into the historical context of this person's name, but you have to understand that God himself met with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 and said, if you follow and listen to me, the whole world will be blessed, and out of you I will make an amazing nation. I will make an amazing nation. I promise that I will be with you if you obey me. Problem is, the people were not obeying. And so, he's named his third child. God has said, name them, you are not my people. Literally saying, I will disinherit you. I will disinherit you from the covenant that we made with Abraham back in Genesis 12, your father Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The language and the intensity of this is missed by us. But I want you to get a picture. Here's a guy, and his ministry in life is to be a prophet of God. And God says, no, you're not just going to speak it. You're going to live the story. I want you to grab this wayward woman, make her your wife, who constantly goes back and whores behind your back. And then I want you to have three children, and I want you to name each of them with a highly significant, historically context conversation, because I am trying to intervene and give a picture to my people so that they understand their wayward ways. Hosea is full of these pictures. Full of them. If I can, let me just try and give you four little pictures in Hosea to describe the intensity. The next picture we go to is a picture that we go to because the idolatry was so pervasive. The idolatry was so pervasive. So actually, if you turn to Hosea 4:12, this is what it says. This is one of the messages that Hosea was trying to get across. My people inquire of a piece of wood. In other words, there is a statue made of wood, and they inquire of this idol what to do, and their walking staff gives them oracles. Literally what was happening is they made this idol of wood, and then their staff, because it was made of wood, they superstitiously thought that the power was coming from the wood. So all trees, all wood, superstition, and they would literally walk down the road with their staff, and as they were walking down the staff, if they came to an intersection and they didn't really know exactly where they wanted to go, they would take their staff, and they would let it go, and the direction in which it fell is the way that they would walk. I mean, we're talking the beginnings of the Ouija board here, okay? Literally, that's what they would do. They would put it down, and they would just start it, and they'd let it fall down. Or if they had a question they wanted to answer, if it falls to the right, it's yes. If it falls to the left, it's no. They would sit there. What an image that he's trying to give to them. He says, listen, my people inquire of a piece of wood, and their walking staff gives them oracles, for their spirit of whoredom has led them astray, and they have left their God to play a whore. Now, I've been in church my whole life. How many of you remember going back in Sunday school? You guys remember this idea of flannel graph? How many of you guys remember flannel graph? I never saw flannel graph on this verse. You know what I'm talking about, flannel graph? I never saw a flannel graph story with this verse. This is intense language. He's trying to make a point that these idols are the things that you're whoring with instead of the covenant relationship that you should have with your spouse, which is me, your God. Tense picture. But there was love. Some people in this day and age love God. Obviously, Hosea was one of them. But there were other people who would go to the temple and they would be excited about being there and all, woo, woo, we're Jesus, whatever, we're God, God, we're here. And then they'd walk away and it'd be gone. Look at this verse in chapter 6. Chapter 6 in Hosea, different picture. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? And what shall I do with you, O God, O Judah? Your love is like the morning cloud. Like the dew that goes away. This morning I woke up. I work at Camperia and it's on a lake. And there was a heavy cloud. It was intense. You couldn't even see the other side of the lake. In fact, a boat just going a few hundred yards off of the shore could not be seen. The cloud was intense. But by 8 o'clock in the morning, it was burnt off because of the sun. You know what he's trying to tell the people here? You know, some of you guys, you show up at the temple, you're all big and sanctimonious, you're all excited about it. Woo, woo, God, God. But it's gone by 8 o'clock in the morning. You have an intensity that you think is there, but it's very, very temporary. Just like the dew that is glistening on the leaves in the morning, but gone by mid-morning because of the intensity of the heat of the sun. Amazing pictures. Amazing pictures of what is actually happening here. Look at the next picture that he does. This one is unbelievable. Hosea 8. Verse 9, look at this picture. This is pretty good. For they have gone up to Assyria. Here's what you need to know. They were a very wealthy, wealthy, wealthy community at that point. And so they went up to Assyria like a wild donkey wandering alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. Let me tell you the context of this verse so you can get a picture of what he's saying here. Here's literally what had happened. They were so wealthy, they went and hired the Assyrians as mercenaries to protect and to fight their wars. You say, well, that's not so bad. Here's what you have to understand. In the history and in the context of God's people, God was the one who always fought the wars. You have intense stories throughout the Bible. Gideon is one that just jumps to mind, where 300 people from the people of God went up against almost 100,000 people, and they won the battle because God was with them. And what he's saying here, this intense language, is saying, you don't need me. You take your money and your wealth, and you're creating your own space. You're creating your own protection. And so you go up and you buy your protection. You buy your protection instead of relying on your protection that I am giving you. But the imagery he says here is this: like a wild donkey wandering. First of all, wild, not tamed, not enclosed, completely outside of the bounds of any authority. Wild donkey, which even to this day is used as a connotation for people who lack understanding. Typically, it's used a different word that I probably won't say right here. It starts with an A and ends with two S's. That right there is what he's saying. You're like a wild donkey, what? Wandering. Aimlessly trying to find out what's up in my life and why my life seems the way it is. You are like a wild, ununderstanding creature that is wandering alone. Alone because you have left me. I want to be with you, but you have left me. The intensity of the language. The pictures that he's trying to create. You inquire of a piece of wood. Your love is intense, but it's like the morning cloud. You're wandering around like a wild donkey. I am your God. I will protect you. But their affluence was so much. They had so much that they didn't think they needed God. In fact, we see that in the next verse, Hosea 10, the next picture. Look at the intensity of this picture. Israel is a luxuriant vine. A luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. Think about that. It's a vine of luxury, a high-end vine that yields great fruit. In other words, it has a lot to offer. Big, plump grapes, in this case, if it's a vine. Big, plump. You guys have overabundance. And the more the fruit increases, the more altars he builds. As his country improved, he improved his pillars. What you have to understand in terms of the conversation that God was trying to have with his people, here's what you have to understand. Those altars and those pillars were to foreign gods. Because they had actually misallocated the source of the resource. They had misallocated the source of the resource. They thought that they were getting all this abundance because of the foreign gods that they were worshiping. They were worshiping these gods and they were increasing their wealth. And so as they increased wealth, they increased their superstition. Really, that's what you have to understand. One of the ways that you identify whether you are being idolatrous, because an idol isn't always just something that you have that literally is the shape of a human. An idol can be anything. Idolatry is lived in this day and age far beyond the scope of some kind of a statue or figurine that looks like a human. Idolatry could be anything. Anything that takes place of God in your life, anything that draws you away from Him, is an idol. And we become very superstitious. You think about this, right? I'm going to go fishing. I need my lucky hat. I know, now I'm treading on people's stuff here right now. I'm sorry. You go, what about if you go golfing? Well, if I go golfing, I got my little thing that I do. I got to go do my thing. I got my swing. I got my glove. I got these little idiosyncratic things that we put, and somehow this is what gives birth at the end. This idea and this lifestyle that you're looking for something else to provide for you. It's kind of hard at this moment as we look at the language that is used in the scripture. And we look at Hosea. Some of us, in fact, many people who are maybe exposed to this book for the first time, when they read this scripture, it really is so intense. The language is so intense that they go like, how could this be a loving God? You think about it. Do you ever talk to anybody like this anymore? Hey, Hosea, go get yourself a whore and have three kids, and you don't even get to choose their name. The names are going to be Jezreel, which means God sows and he's going to reap. No mercy, and you're not my people. That's the story of your context. I know that every other day or every other week, you're going to show up to your house and your wife is gone and with another man, and it's going to make you intensely angry, but just understand that I'm asking you to live this way so that the people of Israel can understand what is going on. Then he says, hey, they're inquiring of a piece of wood. Tell them they're inquiring of the wood and that they literally are giving themselves away, whoring with other gods instead of connecting with the true God. The intensity of this language is so much for me at times. It's hard to really even grasp that it's coming from God. Beyond that, he says, your love is passionate. It's gone by eight. And you're like a wild donkey wandering alone. The wealth that you give, you're misappropriating it and giving it to something else that doesn't even connect. But God's love is amazingly passionate in this book. He's in an intervention, and he's doing it because he cares. He cares so much that it just oozes out of him as he speaks through this book. I hope if nothing else today, you're so enraptured with this book that you're going to go back and read it. Before we go, look at in chapter 11, verse 8 and 9. These verses, unbelievable. Look what he says here. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over? It's almost like God is like going, how could I punish them so much? How could I do it? He says, how can I make you like Adman? How can I treat you like Zeboiim? See, those two cities don't mean much to you, because you don't really know. In fact, possibly most of you don't even know what. Here's what you need to know that gives you kind of a picture of what he's talking about. Those two cities were in the exact same plane as Sodom and Gomorrah. You guys know what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. Complete annihilation by God himself because of the sin that was in there. These cities were those. And he's going, how can I destroy you completely? How can I do this? How can I destroy you? Listen to this. Listen to this word picture. He says, my heart recoils within me, and my compassion grows warm and tender. This is God almost speaking to himself about himself. He says, as I think about the destruction, because you are out whoring with other gods, and you're not your creator, the Father. You are my people. I am your God. Even though you're away, my heart recoils. It recoils within me, thinking of the fact that I might have to destroy you. How can I do this? How can I do it? My heart recoils. My heart recoils because he's in an intense conversation. But he says, my compassion grows warm and tender. Isn't that amazing verbiage? Look what he says in the next verse, verse 9. Notice in this verse it says, I will not execute my burning anger. He starts again the same phrase in the same fashion. I will not again destroy Ephraim. Look at the last phrase in this verse. Once again he says, I will not come in wrath. Three times in this verse he says, I will not. But the most amazing part of this verse, and truly probably the most favorite of mine of the verses I've showed you, is this one phrase in verse 9. It says, For I am God and not man. How can he, how can he restrain himself? He can restrain himself because he is God and he is not man. You say, Nathan, help me understand the intensity of where your mind's going with this because I'm not getting it. What happens, what has usually happened if, for example, one man walks into the room, into his own bedroom, he walks into his own bedroom, and as he walks into his own bedroom, he sees his wife with another man. What typically happens? Where does our mind go? The rage, the emotion of the moment is too much. The rage, the intensity of mankind who cannot control themselves, the intensity fires up, ensues a fight, and in many times, somebody dies. What God is saying here, he says, how do I control my rage? I control my rage because I'm not man. I'm God. I am all-powerful, the Alpha and the Omega, able to restrain even myself. And he gives us such a clear picture of his intense love. He says, I walk into my bedroom every day and I see you. And I ask you, why are you doing what you're doing? I love you. I want to be with you. What is the response that he's looking for? Here's the response. You go to the last chapter in the book and you can see the response that he is asking of his people. Here it goes. You ready? We're going to read through this very quickly. Verse 1. Return to me, O Israel, the Lord your God, for you have stumbled. Notice, it's a temporary action. You have but stumbled. Because of your iniquity, take with you words and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all my iniquity, because I will, God says. Accept what is good, and we will pay with bulls the vows of our lips. What you have to understand about the context of that conversation is the bull is the highest form in the Levitical construct of worship. The bull is the highest payment. And what he's saying is, don't just tell me, show me. Assyria will not save us. Get rid of that idea that somebody else is going to save you. I will save you. We will not ride on horses, and we will say no more our God to the work of our hands. We will say no more that the idols is what's giving us what we have. In you, the orphan finds mercy. And if you do that, what happens? Verse 4, I will heal you. You're sick, but I will heal your apostasy. I will love you freely, for my anger has turned away. I will be like the dew, the moisture in a very dry land, which is Israel, very desert community. That is how they got their moisture, the dew. I will be like that dew to Israel, and you will blossom like a lily. You'll come forth and give fruit. You will be beautiful to all who see you. And you will take root like the trees of Lebanon, which were legendary in the day. You will take root. You will be established, is what he's saying. And your shoots, not only will you be established, but you will spread out. You will multiply. His beauty shall be like the olive. You have to understand that olives were used for fragrance back in the day. And the olive trees, beautiful hardwood on the inside. I don't know if you've ever seen it in the middle of a cross-section of an olive tree, but it's absolutely intense and beautiful. And the other thing about an olive tree is they last forever. They're very, very long-lasting trees, established. And its fragrance like Lebanon. And they shall return and dwell beneath my shadow, and they shall flourish like grain. Look at these words, flourish. My shadow, in the Psalms he says, you will come to me like a chick. You will come to me like a little chick, and I will be your hen under the shadow of my wings. And you will flourish like the grain, they shall blossom like the vine. Their fame shall be like the wine of Lebanon. The key verse is verse 9. This is the last verse of the entire book. And this is the key verse of the entire of Hosea in my mind. Verse 9 says this, "Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the upright walk in them, but transgressors will stumble in them." You go, wow, Nathan, intense book. It is. You know what's amazing about this, though? This same God is trying to connect with you. This same God loves you with an intensity that is hard for us to comprehend. That's why John 3:16 is such an amazing verse. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life." This same God who speaks to the people of Israel is speaking to you today. In fact, I dare to say that one of these images has come to mind. One of these images, you think about these images, these four images that I gave you, one of them probably connects at some level. Are you superstitious in your life? Are you worshiping? Is there something that is controlling your life? Is there an idol? Is there something that is controlling the space in your life more than God itself? Think of that picture. Is there possibly an intensity in your relationship that is great? You show up every Sunday morning in church, but by about 10:10, it's wore off. In other words, when you walk out of the door, you've checked your box and you've walked away from it. You're not living the life. God's saying, no, no, no. The life that you live with me is not lived within these four walls. It's lived in the community we live in. Or are you wandering like a wild donkey, just doing your own thing, thinking that somehow you can find safety, security, and protection, and that somehow you will be able to sustain yourself in this world? Like you really think you have all that it takes. The image for you is that you are a wild donkey wandering around alone. Or are you going to rely on your wealth? You thinking, my bank account is padded. I have what it takes to weather the storm because I have built it up. And I continue to garner my wealth because I think that that's going to protect me in the day. As the band comes up, I'm going to ask you to consider this. What image is coming to mind? Maybe you just need to sit here and sing a song of how great God is because of the enormity of the love that he has for us. Maybe right where you are in your space, in your pew, you need to just pray and say, God, this image has come to mind. This is something that I need to reckon with. And I just ask you, Lord, I'm sorry for this. I come to you. He will reach out to you. Maybe you feel like you need somebody to pray with. If you need somebody to pray with, come down right here. Somebody will pray with you and walk you through that conversation. Maybe you're here for the first time. This is your first time with any kind of God conversation. And you're going, I finally feel like what you're saying, that I found what I've been looking for. And if that's the case, come down. If not, stand with us. Let's worship our great God who loves us.